make sure I start this recording just so that we can record it for the members who can't make it. All right. So, Bill, thank you so much for being here. I have some questions for you. I know some people have some questions. You have a list of questions. Sure. Primarily, I'd like to talk about the two new acts that are going to be put into effect on the 10th of this month. And then after that, if we can have you for a little bit longer to talk about lease options, and then love to hear, you know, kind of talk about yourself, because you are a wealth of information. I know doing this for double the time that I've been, or maybe even triple, so we could all
Don't go dating me there, buddy. telling my age, okay.
So please, you have the floor, and I will. I try not to cut you off, but if I have anything pressing, I'll add it and or ask questions. And if I see anybody else with a hand raised, we'll get to them. Or if there's a question that comes in, I'll ask that.
Okay. So basically, what you had asked me to talk about was the Dodd-Frank Act. And one of the major questions that I get about that is exactly what is the Dodd-Frank Act? And that was an act signed into law by President Obama back in July of 2010. Okay, the rules and regs finally came out January of 2013, and it goes into effect this week, okay, on January 10th of 2014. And basically it was designed in order to prevent predatory lending practices, was what they said that it was for. So it is going to cover just about anything that has to do with finance. They are to protect consumers from hidden fees, deceptive practices, and abusive terms, or, you know, what basically was considered predatory lending. It is going to be enacted and enforced by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which kind of gives me shivers anytime I hear consumer and protection in the same sentence. But that is right now part of the Federal Reserve System. It's headed up by a director and a deputy that's selected by the president. Unfortunately, it is an agency that is unregulated. It doesn't answer to anyone, which kind of gives me problems with that. But a lot of the things that were covered at one time by other agencies are going to be transferred over to this particular bureau now. And they're going to cover just about everything that has to do with finance. So they're going to be dealing with student loans, debit and credit, debit cards, credit cards, those types of things. Okay, so they're going to oversee all of that. But the one that we are mostly concerned with, as far as investors are concerned, is the Dodd-Frank Act and what basically that's going to do to seller financing. Okay, another question I get is, who does the act affect? Indirectly, I think it affects all investors because it's going to affect the way that everybody gets loans for the purchase of their homes or their investment properties now. So indirectly, it's going to affect all of us. Directly, it's going to affect those who are going to do any type of seller financing. Okay. Let's see, another question I get is, what does the Dodd-Frank Act mean to us as investors? Again, it's going to affect all of us who do any type of seller financing. Another question is, what happens if I don't follow all the rules? There are severe penalties for Dodd-Frank. Basically, what this means is that as a seller, if you do any type of seller financing, you are going to have to make a good faith determination that you have considered your borrower's ability to repay the loan. Okay. So, I mean, you know, on the surface, it sounds like it has pretty good intent. However, the way it's going to mainly affect us is if we are found in not to be compliant with Dodd-Frank. And the penalties of that can be pretty severe. You have to pay back the last 3 years of payments that your borrower has made to you. And I think that's pretty significant. Are there any exceptions to Dodd-Frank? Is a question that I often get asked. That is... you know, the Dodd-Frank is really going to cover only transactions that have a consumer loan that is secured by a dwelling. So if you do any cash type transactions, they're not going to be affected. Any cash sales, things of that nature, any investor to investor deals. So those of you who are doing wholesale deals and you're just assigning a contract to another investor, you're okay. If you do commercial real estate, a lot of people doing apartment buildings and things of that nature, if you do commercial real estate, you will not be affected in those types of transactions. Those of us who do transactions with owner occupants, that's where we're going to run into the problem. So it only affects those types of deals.
Understood.
Sorry?
Understood. Now, a lot of the folks here listening to you have certainly other single families, perhaps investing in notes, but the main group that we have here is definitely with regards to mobile homes attached to private land, mobile homes in parks. One of the strategies that we use, which you and I talked about on an earlier talk, was selling a home and the home is with selling the property that is not secured, creating a note that does not have a mortgage, there's no collateral. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that
Absolutely.
Into the future.
Okay. Yeah, the way it's working right now is Dodd-Frank applies to any type of transaction that is going to be secured by a loan on a residence, okay? So it is only for secured transactions. If you do not secure the transaction with that property, then you're going to be safe on that. It's kind of, you know, a lot of people say, who would go out and do an unsecured note? You know, I've seen people who do it, you know? And if you do have an unsecured note at this point, it is not going to be covered under Dodd-Frank, so it won't fall under any of those rules and regs. It's only those that are going to be secured by a dwelling. And I think we had talked about, you know, whether some states would consider a mobile home to be real property or personal property. We've done a little more investigating in that. Since a mobile home is considered to be a dwelling and Dodd-Frank specifies that it is on a dwelling, then it would be covered.
Right. Yeah.
So your transactions with mobile homes are going to be covered on that.
Now, even a, I think you might have said this, but even a houseboat would be considered a dwelling. I mean, that's...
Believe it or not, if it's considered a dwelling, all right, and a houseboat is, because you know people who live on the houseboats. If it happens to be on a houseboat that is considered to be a dwelling, then it's going, and the mortgage is secured by that houseboat, that mortgage is going to fall under Dodd-Frank. It's crazy how some of this is going to be enacted.
Somebody posted a, or one of my members here, Dave, he posted one of those infographics where it was all about the Dodd-Frank, and it showed that there was only about 24% of the entire mortgage reform that was going to be happening, all the proposed new rules, legislation, only about 24% of it was even finalized or even proposed. Do you, me and you were talking that in the future, you know, the CFPB may see, you know, well, hey, listen, we got to do something about these unsecured liens or these unsecured notes. So is that sort of the time that in this next 75%, or is this infographic even correct where it was alluding to that, or any thoughts on
well,
that?
Well, you know, I would have to – I'm not familiar with the infographic, so I'm not sure exactly what it's referring to. All I know is what it's – you know, what it's affecting right now. And basically, I think what it says is very, very broad when it comes out and defines, you know, what is going to be covered when it specifically says a dwelling, you know. So that sounds like any type of owner-occupant property is what it's looking at right now. And so maybe it's talking about other types of loans that need to be secured or other types of legislation or other types of rules and regs or interpretations. But I've not seen the graphic, so I'm not sure exactly what it's referring to.
Okay. Fair enough. Now, you said about the penalties. Now,
yes.
Sort of a question with that. Is there going to be somebody who is scouring the public records at the courthouse steps waiting for you with a net, or is this going to be sort of for the buyer that you have to, and maybe an attorney to approach them or
you and I had kind of talked about that as well. Basically, you know, some people says, well, how is the government going to enforce this? How are they going to know? They don't care. You know, they aren't going to go looking. Although I will tell you, I went to the CFPB site just the other day after we had even talked. They have added a complaint section. Okay. So, and it specifically says if you feel that you have been a victim of predatory lending, please let us know. All right. And it gives a place where you can file a complaint with them directly. So I don't think they're going to go out looking. I think they're going to wait for complaints to come in and then they're going to do investigation. Okay. I think for us as investors, the biggest problem is going to be these sue happy lawyers that might be out there, because if you've got a buyer who has been, you know, they bought from you using seller financing, and a few years down the road they can't make payments anymore. Okay, they're going to go to court to try to prove that you did not take into consideration their ability to repay to try to avoid the transaction. And I can see now, you know, several years ago when personal injury attorneys got into the act of advertising and saw all these billboards up and down the road saying, you know, if you've been hit or injured in an automobile accident, come see us. I can see now all of these attorneys with billboards saying, if you are losing your house due to foreclosure or you can't pay your loan anymore, come to us and we'll be able to get, you know, the last 3 years of your payments back. So I think it's going to be at that level. I think it's going to be where someone gets ill at you as the lender and they take you to court and sue.
Oh, what a country.
And we sue for everything, you know. That doesn't. Yeah. That's, and I think that they'll be taking you to court even if they do not prevail. I think it would still be tried in court, because once you get there, they've still got to prove that you did not comply with Dodd-Frank if your transaction is even covered by Dodd-Frank. First, they've got to show that it's covered, and then they've got to prove that you did not comply.
This will be interesting to see moving forward. Do you have an idea of the folk? Now, I imagine that big banks are protecting themselves. They're not going to get. I mean, they have folks on their side. They know what they're doing. They're not going to put themselves in a position. Do you feel that most of these suits, most of these slip and falls, but for the Dodd-Frank are going to be investors?
I think it's going to be small investors. I think it's going to be small investors, and I think it's going to be for that very reason that you said. You know, the big boys are going to protect themselves. Not only that, believe it or not, I think that conventional financing is going to be much harder to get for some because of Dodd-Frank in a way. Because you look at it this way, most institutions I think are going to scale back on their residential mortgages and focus on less risky activities. And banks have a lot of other activities. You know, people think that mortgages might make up the bulk of it. There are banks that do commercial lending. They do other types of investing. And I think that's what they're going to move into instead of doing riskier mortgage loans, residential loans.
So
okay,
overall,
so they're going to protect themselves that way.
Do you foresee rent going up? And that's it?
Do I foresee rent going up?
I would
foresee rent going up if people are not going to be able to get money to buy conventional housing. I think there's going to be a bigger demand on rents. We've seen that with the foreclosures and things in effect. Although believe it or not, with Dodd-Frank, they're going to be fewer foreclosures, I believe. For the simple reason, Dodd-Frank requires the lender to show that they have attempted loan modification. Not just the big boys. They're going to force smaller lenders to show that they have considered an attempted loan modification. And not only that, there is a 4-month window, 120 days required delinquency before you can even file foreclosure notice. So, you know, it's not one of those things of where, you know, your borrower can be 30 days behind, 60 days behind, not anymore. Okay? They've got to be 120 days in arrearage before you can even file a notice of foreclosure, not much less start the process. You can't even file a notice for 120 days.
How about now, does that start on January 10th, 120 days from January?
Yeah, that starts on January 14th, and it's only for loan applications taken after. January 10th, 2014, and it's only for loan applications taken after that date. Now there is a question, and a lot of people up in the air about it: are you going to start the date from there, or does the activity have to be from there? In other words, let's say that you've got a loan that's already 5 years into its term, and then it gets ready to go into foreclosure, are you going to have to wait the 120 days? And CFPB hasn't come down with an interpretation on that yet. What they have strictly said was that it doesn't apply to any loans prior to January 10 of 2014. So most of us are hoping that they don't try to say any foreclosure action after that date, that it can only happen on loans that have been taken out after that date.
Understood. Now, okay. I know that there are a number of questions left when you emailed me over here. Moving forward, we're talking about, you know, what you can't do. What can you, let's talk about a single family residence or even a manufactured home attached to land. They're very similar in many ways. When you go to resell that with a secured note to an end user, somebody that's going to live there, what's the silver lining? I've been hearing three per year.
The number.
A few other things.
Yes. Some people have asked me, and that's a good question. Basically, it's, are there any exceptions to Dodd-Frank, or are there any transactions that are not covered by Dodd-Frank? First, you have to look at it and say, are you a creditor under Dodd-Frank? Most of the time, you are. If the loan is being secured by a dwelling, you're covered by Dodd-Frank. You just got to find out whether there are any exceptions to you having to undergo all those hateful underwriting requirements. And yes, they are. And it is a numbers rule. Remember, though, that there are two types of acts that really cover us, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with both the SAFE Act and the Dodd-Frank. SAFE Act having to do with mortgage loan originators, whether you have to have a mortgage loan originator to do your paperwork. And the SAFE Act, whether you have to jump through all these hoops as far as underwriting is concerned. Okay, the magic number for the Dodd-Frank and the underwriting rules and regs is 5. Okay, if you do 5 or fewer transactions per year, then you are safe. Okay, and that is per year, all right, not per calendar year, but per 12 months. So it's a rolling number. So from the time you do your first transaction, you've got 12 months that you can do up to 5 transactions. All right. Now, the rule for mortgage loan originator, whether you have to have someone actually do your paperwork, that falls under the SAFE Act, and that is really a state number that's handled at the state level. And most of the states that I have seen, if they follow the federal rules and regs, that magic number happens to be 3. So you can do up to 3 transactions, all right, without having to have a mortgage loan originator.
Okay.
And if you stay within those numbers, then you fall outside of Dodd-Frank coverage. Okay. But one caveat that I would throw out with that, if you are going to say, okay, I'm going to keep myself safe so that I won't have to comply with Dodd-Frank, I'm only going to do 4 or 5 seller finance transactions per year. Okay. You need to disclose in your paperwork, I think, you need to put in your paperwork somewhere that that the loan that you are making or the loan that you are – the seller financing, the paper that you're taking back is not covered by the Dodd-Frank Act. And the reason I suggest that is a good attorney would go to court and sue you anyway, and he would say, oh, but Your Honor, my client is a victim, and had my client known that this guy was only going to do 3 transactions this year and not be covered by Dodd-Frank, he would have never borrowed the money from him, right? So – I feel that in this case you probably need to go into full disclosure and make sure that if you are not going to have to comply with Dodd-Frank that you disclose that in your paperwork, in with your other disclosures.
Understood. That was one of the
my opinion.
Oh, that's no. Please, all the opinions you have are. Specifically what you were saying. When you talked on the Bigger Pockets with Sharon, Chan,
yes.
Sharon, that was a great. I believe everybody here listening today has watched that video. I've asked them to, and I do remember that. That was covered. Now the ability to repay, that's sort of a untested gray area as well, isn't it?
That is a. Untested area. And one of the things you have to look at is first decide whether you're a creditor under terms of Dodd-Frank. If you're going to do seller financing, yes, you are a creditor. All right, then you've got to look with, okay, am I going to do more than 5 transactions? If you're going to do more than 5 transactions, then you know you're going to have to comply with Dodd-Frank. Okay, and you've got to follow all the rules and regs and the underwriting and stuff like that. Dodd-Frank does provide what they call a safe harbor, okay? And that safe harbor is called a qualified mortgage. And so if you write or your paper is considered what is a qualified mortgage, it's presumed that you complied with Dodd-Frank. Somebody says, well, how is that a safe harbor? Well, if you go to court and you are sued for noncompliance, the burden of proof is on the plaintiff that you did not comply because it's automatically assumed that you did. In other words, it's in your favor almost to have a qualified loan when you go into court because it's assumed that you did follow Dodd-Frank. The only problem with qualified loan is it can't have any negative amortization. It can't have a balloon payment. Okay, it can't exceed a 30-year term. There cannot be a prepayment penalty unless it follows a particular schedule that they haven't even sent out to anybody yet. They've not published it yet. And it can have variable interest rates, but there are very strict guidelines that variable interest rate has to follow. And you have to consider the debt-to-income ratio, and that debt-to-income ratio can only be 43%. So I think it's going to be very, very difficult to write a qualified mortgage. And that's your safe harbor. If you are not going to take advantage of that safe harbor, then you've got to go over and look at 8 underwriting criteria. And that 8 underwriting criteria includes their current income and assets. You've got to check their employment status. You've got to check their credit history. You've got to see what that monthly mortgage payment is going to do and whether they're going to be able to make that specific monthly mortgage payment. You've got to look at that mortgage payment and say, okay, here's the principal amount, and first decide whether they can afford the principal amount, and then you've got to look at all the other additions, like if there's any escrow on it. And remember, we're talking about the banks, so they might have taxes and insurance and everything else included in with that mortgage payment, okay? And if you chose to do that, you'd have to consider that as well. You've got to look at their other debts, like child support and alimony, and then you've got to look at their debt-to-income ratio. Again, it's got to be they don't specify here under this 8 that they don't specify what the number is, which is kind of interesting, I thought. They don't say it's got to be 43%, but you've got to document that you have at least looked at it and considered it. And I think if you go with a very high debt-to-income ratio, they'd say, you know, his debt-to-income ratio is 60%. How did you think this guy was going to make his payment? You know, that type of thing. But you've got to consider all 8 of those factors. You have got to document how you looked at all 8 of those factors, and you've got to keep that documentation for over 3 years, which I think is kind of strange because, you know, most mortgages have got to be 30 years, but you're only required to keep the documentation for 3.
Okay. Can you talk now with the safe harbor qualified mortgages?
Yes.
Who can write a qualified mortgage? Is this for any civilian, or does it have to be a?
No. As long as you follow and meet the requirements, the no negative amortization, the no balloon, the not exceeding a 30-year term, no prepayments, your loan is qualified. It doesn't make any difference who you are writing it. It's the loan itself that makes it a qualified loan.
Understood.
Okay. So you could write a qualified loan.
Understood.
Under Dodd-Frank, it's just that how many people are going to be able to meet those requirements when you've got that 43% debt-to-income ratio.
Right.
Because if it falls outside that 43% debt-to-income ratio, it automatically is not a qualified loan anymore. It doesn't matter if it meets all the other requirements.
Now, is the 43, that's on the household? Is that
That's on whoever's qualifying for the loan. So if you've got both people qualifying for the loan and it's a joint loan, then it would be 43% in total. So it's who's qualifying for the loan.
Okay, understood. Sort of changing the topic up a little bit. If I hypothetically we were, let's say for example, there's a property that it's a single family home, and we're talking to a seller, and this is sort of a pie in the sky world. I don't know if there's any deals that would work like this, but hypothetically, single family seller, we negotiate a deal for $20,000. We find a buyer who wants to pay $50,000. The home is worth $40,000. The seller writes a note. The buyer for $50,000 promises to pay $50,000 to the seller. We go ahead and we give the seller the $20,000 we agreed to and purchase that note. Your thoughts there? If that makes sense.
I'm trying to follow that. All right. So the buyer signs a note for $50,000?
For $50,000, which is the price that, as the investor, that's what we would have sold it for. The seller, they just want their $20,000 cash. So after this note is created, then the investor steps in and gives the seller their $20,000 cash for the discounted or for the note to take the discount, and now we are holding on to a $50,000 note that we went ahead and purchased for $20,000. Is the investor at all liable, or is because the buyer and seller? Because the investor is sort of at an arm's length away, and this note was created between the buyer and the seller, and then the investor came in afterwards. Even if the investor sort of not facilitated, but definitely knew what was going on, the investor purchases.
I think that the investor might be okay if he knew what was going on. I think that if the investor had anything to do with it and the buyer could prove that the investor kind of helped facilitate the transaction, there might be a problem. But if you could make sure that it stayed completely arm's length, number one, the note is between the original owner and the buyer. Okay, so the seller, all right, we'll look at it as the seller. The seller would be the one that would be liable for Dodd-Frank. Okay? However, most of the time, that's the only transaction that this seller may have done all year long, so it would fall outside of Dodd-Frank anyway. And then if you, as the investor, just bought the note, okay, under basic business law, you would be a holder in due course, if you remember that.
Yeah.
You know, yep. that terminology. So you would just be stepping into the shoes of the investor, I mean of the seller. And so I don't think that would be, you know, I don't think that would fall under Dodd-Frank at this point. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, that's that was posed to me by a member, and
uh-huh.
Yeah, it was. I was going to wait. I was going to wait to.
Was that the conclusion that you reached as well?
I wasn't completely confident. That's what my gut was telling me.
Well,
however,
and you know what? You know, John, both of us, and we'll say this right out, we're not giving any legal advice or accounting advice.
Mm-hmm.
All right, but you and I both have kind of read this law, and I think that we both are of the same understanding. You know, the original deal was between the seller and the buyer. Okay, and we just come in and we just purchase the note. Some basic business law says that we're just stepping into the shoes of the original seller. And if the original seller was not covered under Dodd-Frank or did not fall under Dodd-Frank, then we wouldn't either as the investor. But as I said, I would make that as a caveat that's the way I interpret it right now, because I think if a lot of that begins happening, you know, I think that it will be looked at down the road. But that's just me. That's just my opinion.
Oh, better be safe than sorry. And
right. Right.
You know, us selling investor to investor, that mm-hmm. falls outside of the.
Oh, that's totally outside Dodd-Frank, because remember that Dodd-Frank only applies to what is considered consumer credit. Okay, and a consumer credit is like an owner occupant. The consumer that's going to use it. So
primary,
investor
secondary.
To investor. Right. Oh, it doesn't make any difference. You know, a lot of people – I've heard some attorneys say, oh, it only applies to the primary residence. I disagree. Okay? I disagree. And
right.
You know what? I hope that they can prove me wrong. I've asked them. I say, show me the rule and reg and show me in the law where it makes that statement. Because, you know, when I read it, that section, 1026 specifically says that it is on a dwelling – okay, and it doesn't say that dwelling is defined as a primary residence. It can be your primary residence. It can be a vacation home. It can be a condo. It can be a houseboat. You know, if it's a dwelling, 1 to 4 units, okay, then I think it falls under Dodd. I think that's considered consumer credit or a consumer loan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's.
Yep. So, yeah, you know, one of the things that another question I got, and you have to excuse me for rambling at the beginning. I was trying to think of all these questions that
sure.
I was asked about Dodd-Frank. One of the things some people says, how does it affect my rental units? It doesn't affect your rental units at all. Okay, so that's because that's a commercial business unit. It only affects something where there is a financing instrument. Okay, and another question is, will it hurt wholesalers? No, it won't hurt wholesalers if you're doing true wholesaling, because all you're doing is assigning your contract to another investor, right? So it's not going to affect wholesaling business. You can keep on and carry on doing that as you would. I think it would affect rehabbers who used to do fix and flips and then finance it to an owner-occupant, right?
Sure.
If that's the type of rehabbing that you did, I think you would be affected by Dodd-Frank. But if you do a rehab and you sell to another investor who's going to use it as a rental property and you do seller financing, then it doesn't. So it's going to be looked at on a transaction-by-transaction basis. Right? Another question I get, will I still be able to do lease options? And, you know, this was one that was really a concern of mine, because that's been my niche for, you know, a few decades, as you said, right? And if you do what is called a true, if you do a true lease option, okay, you're not going to be affected by it, because a true lease option is not a financing instrument. You're not financing the property. You're not selling to a to an owner occupant. You are you have a tenant in there with the right to purchase and become an owner occupant, but you're not selling it to them during the course of the lease and option. So a lease and option deal is not going to be covered under Dodd-Frank. That being said, we all know that how when tenants start getting evicted and they want to try to get their lease option fee, that we always say is a non-refundable lease option fee, and they want to get that back, you know, they go into court and cry before the judge and all this kind of stuff. If you ever, if that ever happened and the judge said, oh, guess what, this wasn't really a lease and a option, this is an installment sale, and reclassify it like Internal Revenue Service tries to do and call it an installment sale, as soon as it's reclassified as an installment sale, you become liable for Dodd-Frank, because then it is a financing instrument.
Yep.
So you have to keep that in mind when you're doing your transactions.
The difference between a true lease option and a more – if there's a – sort of a left side and a right side, the lease option mm-hmm. side versus anything that looks like an installment sale, would you say that mm-hmm. that is it money that's taken during the lease option that's applied to the principal of the home? Is it where you mix funds together? Is it in the paperwork itself,
I think what the judge is going to try to do, and this is my suspicions from past dealings, because right now there is nothing really for a judge to hang his hat on and say, okay, what differentiates this between a lease and option and a true installment sale. I think that they're going to fall back on some of the same criteria that Internal Revenue Service uses, because, you know, they're the ones that are notorious for coming in and trying to reclassify a transaction, because they want, you know, they want to treat that as a sale so that they get their money, their taxes on the capital gains. So they have some criteria that they use in trying to judge whether something is a lease, whether it's actually indicative of a straight lease or whether it's indicative of a sale instead. And some of the things they look at is any money, just like you said, is any money that is being received during the term of the lease actually being applied to the purchase price? Does rent credits ring a bell? Right? Remember the old thing when people were saying, oh, give a 50% rent credit, you know, and that'll get people to come in. Oh, I'm not kidding. I've seen one of my best mentors, one of my favorite mentors, used to give 50% rent credits. That was back when there was a lot of equity in the home and there was a big spread, and he would give 50% rent credits because it encouraged people to become the tenant buyer. Of course they wanted to jump in on the deal, because one of the things that we instinctively hated the most was feeling like our rent was going for nothing. So if we could feel like, oh, hey, half my rent's going to pay for the purchase price of the house, that made them feel all warm and cozy, right? So But that's what one thing that I think the courts would look at and say, if you're applying any of that to the house, then you're reducing the principal amount, and therefore it's partly a sale. Another thing I think they'll look at is the term of the lease. You know, if you've got a long-term lease and they're in there for a long period of time, I think that looks more like the sale of a property than you putting somebody in there renting it temporarily, and then they have the option to buy it as soon as they get their credit cleaned up. And I have a good friend who is in real estate, and he came out with lease options and teaching his students how to do lease options. And he was doing like 10 and 15-year lease options, because that was how that they were helping people who were underwater, kind of. So they'd say, okay, by the time – you know, some of this lease is paid down and you've been in there for 10 years, the mortgage is back down to about the approximate price or the value of the house, and you just pay off the mortgage type thing. Okay, I think that's going to be indicative of an installment sale. So they're going to look at the terms, how long it is, whether any of the monies are being applied to the purchase price.
That makes perfect sense. If it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's an installment.
The old substance over form, right?
Yes. I haven't heard that in a while. Tim, you asked a question maybe a little while ago. Where is it? Do the numbers also, the cap per year, also include unsecured transactions for that year too? And correct me if I'm wrong, Bill, that the unsecured transactions, those do not fall within the scope of these acts.
That is correct. And I think what he's asking is if I do five transactions, would it count within that five? No. You're unsecured and you're secured look separate. So you do five transactions that are secured before you have to fall under Dodd-Frank.
Here is a question, Judy, out of Orlando. You ask, simplistically put, if I carry an unsecured note on a personal property dwelling, aka a mobile home in a park, am I subject to the Dodd-Frank's rule? If so, do I have to qualify the buyer completely by the Dodd-Frank rules?
Okay, now she said unsecured, right? Did she say
correct.
Unsecured or secured?
Unsecured.
Unsecured. Unsecured at this point right now, Judy, I think that you're okay and that you don't fall under Dodd-Frank.
Okay.
Because the way the rule is written right now, it is a consumer loan secured by a dwelling. Okay? So if there is no dwelling securing the loan, then it does not fall under Dodd-Frank, according to 1026, Section 1026.
The few dozen people on the phones, if you came in late, go ahead and press star 2 to raise your hand on the little screen here that I'm looking at online. You press star 2 on the phone, and then that'll show me that you want to come on the microphone and ask us a question. And that's how you're going to get your questions through on the phone lines. And then if you're on the computer, go ahead and type in the chat box with your name and email address. Dave, I see you have a couple questions. Switch over to that screen. Dave out of California and Cindy, hope you two are both here, asks, first question, can you go through an example of the debt-to-income ratio?
A debt-to-income ratio, basically what they do is they take what they refer to as your consumer debt, okay? They total your consumer debt, and they divide it by your income. And that ratio has got to be 43% or less. In other words, your consumer debt can only be up to 43% of your total income. That's the best example that I could give.
Perfect. And consumer debt includes everything coming out of your pockets monthly, whether it be government liens, child supports,
correct.
Phone
yeah,
bills.
It doesn't consider your phone bill and those types of things. Okay. My understanding of it is when it's your debt, and that's not considered a debt, believe it or not. That's considered a living expense. Okay, so living expenses are not included. All right, so it would be your credit card bills. Okay, it would be things like credit cards, student loans, any other types of loans. When we used to be able to go and get these customer loans at like Beneficial Finance and places like that. That type of loan, if you had anything financed at department stores, things of that nature, that would be included in there. Okay, so it doesn't count your living expenses like medical bills. It doesn't include your groceries, light bill, utility bill. None of that is included. Okay, so it's kind of like that credit extension would be included in it in the 43%. And unfortunately, it's not 43% before the loan. They've got to add in the payments for the loan itself and then make the division, and it's got to be 43% or less. And that's why I say it's going to be very difficult for some people to qualify and meet that 43%. Because believe it or not, you remember how difficult it was for some people to qualify this past year for loans, and the DTI was 48%. They've lowered it by 5 percentage points.
And when we're talking about now people that are – we're talking about the mobile home space. And granted, a lot of our buyers are – very competent, hardworking individuals, but needless to say, many of them do have credit extensions on their.
Oh, well, most people have high consumer debt. Fact of life, you know. And if you sit down and think about it, that's why people are going to seller financing anyway. They don't qualify for conventional financing, right? So that's why they're wanting to do seller financing anyway, and that's why I think this is really putting the onus on residential buying, because for those folks who did not qualify for conventional loans, at least they had investors like you and me who would be willing to extend to them seller financing. And we would look at their debt-to-income ratio sometimes, but we would, you know, if they could make the monthly payment, debt-to-income ratio was only a minor consideration. Now, in order for there to be a qualified loan, it has to be 43%, and it's not a minor consideration. That's why I don't think there are going to be very many seller-financed qualified mortgages. Okay, I think that most of the people who are going to be doing seller financing are going to fall over under those 8 criteria where you still have to consider debt-to-income ratio, but they don't tell you what the percentage has to be. So I think that you're going to be able to use a higher percentage on that side using the 8, you know, that 8 underwriting criteria.
Right. It's amazing the government's telling us what to do and what we can't do.
Oh, absolutely. It's interfering. I think they're interfering with our right to contract, because that's basically what a loan is, right?
Right.
It's a contract between the seller and the buyer. Okay. So I think that the government is really interfering greatly with who we can and who we cannot contract with as individuals.
Steve asks, he doesn't ask anything. He says, thank you so much for being available and coming on, Bill.
Oh, quite welcome. Now, do you guys do much with land contracts, John?
No, we do not do much
question.
With land.
Okay. Well, I have a question, you know, quite frequently is, does Dodd-Frank, is a land contract covered under Dodd-Frank? It most definitely is. A land contract is a financing instrument. So I guess what you need to ask yourself is the contract that you are doing between you and your buyer, could that contract be considered a financing instrument? And if it can be considered a financing instrument, you better check to make sure or check to see if you fall under Dodd-Frank with that contract.
Gotcha. Can Dave, you ask another question. How do we document the buyer's that's a good question. How do we document the buyer's ability to pay?
To pay. So he's talking about those 8 factors that we might have to consider. Take a look at those 8 factors. You have to have a loan application of some type. Okay. Then, as far as the current employment status, you would have to show that you checked on their employment and verified their employment. How many of you have actually applied for a loan? If you think back to that procedure, you had to bring in W-2 forms, you probably had to give a tax return, you had an employment verification form that you had to have your employer fill out. Those types of those same types of documentation is what you as the seller financer will now have to do if you undergo those 8 underwriting criteria. And not only that, you have to document your criteria. You have to have written procedures that show that you have considered each one of those factors. I think it's going to be a nightmare. I really do.
And have that, so all that documentation in a file, and then
just as though you were a lending institution, you have to have a file on every person that you have a loan with. You have to have a file that documents that you have checked out all that information on them. And, you know, getting back to mortgage loan originators, we touched briefly on that. Somebody asked me, says, oh, well, what if I get a mortgage loan originator, you know, does that keep me from having to follow Dodd-Frank? Because the mortgage loan originator takes care of all that, okay? Well, you have to have a mortgage loan originator if you do more than 3 transactions, but I hate to tell you, I don't think the buck stops with the mortgage loan originator, because all that person does is take the application and negotiate the terms, right? It's the lender that has the underwriting requirements. And so I think that's going to still fall back on to the seller.
Great point.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to be able to say, I had a mortgage loan originator, so I'm not liable. If you want to get this 3 years payments back, you go to the mortgage loan originator. I don't think that's going to fly.
Great point. Dave asks another question. How do we document that the debt to income to mitigate Dodd-Frank?
Good question. Yeah. Okay. Remember, for somebody who has done a loan application, they have to actually itemize their debts for you. You know, because you asked the question, what are your credit card bills? What are your, do you have child support and alimony? You know, what are your other loans? And you ask them what those monthly payments are, and you write those monthly payments down. And then you add them up, okay? And then you ask, and then you've got their income that they are confirming by W-2 forms or ever how you're getting them to document their income, and you total up the consumer debt, and you divide it by the income that they've told you about, and you say, oh, gosh, that's 43% or less. That's the only documentation. That's how you have to document it. And if you do a credit history on them, run a credit report, remember most of the time their credit card bills and their installment accounts, those types of things, that's what's going to be on their credit report. And that's why if any of you have ever done a loan application, a lot of times they'll say, oh, you need to pay off this credit card or you need to do this and that to get your installment bills down. That was to get your debt-to-income ratio in line.
Perfect sense. So that is so taking everything down, going by the book, following just what you said to make sure that you understand what that credit is, and then,
keeping it in a file. Yeah.
Right.
Because you don't have to worry about changes in their debt to income ratio. You only have to worry about what the debt-to-income ratio is at the time you make the loan. So if they go out and get, you know, a bunch more installment debt 3 or 4 months after you have approved them for your seller-financed transaction, okay, that's on them. You don't have to worry about it. You only have to document what it was at the time that you approved the seller-financed transaction with them.
Okay. That's good to know. I got a question here. So if we get rid of Obama, can we repeal this whole thing?
Actually, it would. Yeah, I mean, you know, this is a law. This is a public law, okay, and it can be repealed just like any other law could. Of course, it would have to go through the process. To right. repeal the entire bill, and it would have to go through that, you know, the votes of the Congress and all that kind of stuff. But could it be repealed? Absolutely, it could be repealed. Will it be repealed? I doubt it, unfortunately. But John, you know what we used to say eons and eons ago, I suppose, is that instead of repealing laws, okay? We just make new laws that counteract the existing laws, right? That's which I always thought was really kind of stupid. Instead of getting rid of the bad laws, we just make another law that overrules that law.
Just
right?
More and more laws,
So what I foresee is not necessarily repealing all of Dodd-Frank. I just see the amendment of huge portions of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's because amendments are easier to do than repeals most of the time.
Huh. That makes sense. Yeah. I could see you get a lot less arguments when you're repealing.
Oh, yeah. Because you know how they amend these. A lot of times they'll tack on these amendments to favored bills. And you don't know what the heck. You don't know what the heck you're appealing or amending. A lot of times, you know, it's like it totally floored me when Nancy Pelosi said that time that nobody really knew what was in Obamacare, so you had to pass it so you could find out what was in it, which I thought was the most ludicrous comment I'd ever heard anybody make, but it was probably true. I like to tell most people, say, "Oh, well, what about Dodd-Frank? If you read it," I said, "Well, you know what? Dodd-Frank is really, it's so convoluted, okay, and you have to read one section to see the definition, and then you say, okay, now what does this really mean? Like, what is a dwelling? And you might have to go three or four sections back to find out what a dwelling is. So, you know, it cross-references each other, and you have to go to different portions of it and stuff like that. I admit it, I am a tax and political junkie, and I read all this crap. I have read literally all of Dodd-Frank Act. I can't say that I've read every single word, but I can pretty well guarantee that I've read more than the folks who voted for it.
Wow. Unbelievable. I'm glad that we have you on here tonight. Go ahead.
Okay, there was another question that I get asked a lot, and this may or may not apply. Some of your folks, they ask about private lenders. You know, those guys who do private loans, and they act as private lenders, and they wanted to know if Dodd-Frank applies to them. It does if they are lending to an owner-occupant. Okay, so I'm suggesting that all of my students who are private lenders, if they don't want to have to comply with Dodd-Frank like regular lending institution, that they don't loan to owner-occupants, that they only deal with investor loans. You know, so make a lot of investor loans, and you're free. You know, it's a freebie. You don't have to worry about complying with Dodd-Frank. But if you are lending to an owner-occupant out of your IRA or any other shape, form, or fashion, you're going to have to comply with Dodd-Frank.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So private lenders, you know, and a lot of people say, oh, it only applies to seller financing. Well, it doesn't. Okay, it applies to private lenders as well. Most of the time, we as investors look at how it applies to seller financing only, but a private lender is doing the same thing that a bank is doing. Right. So if you're a private lender and you loan money to an owner occupant and that loan is secured by a dwelling, then you have to comply with Dodd-Frank. Now, if you want to make a unsecured loan to an owner occupant, then you're free to do that and you don't have to apply it. You don't have to qualify and you don't have to conform to Dodd-Frank.
Here's a question. That goes right into that thought. And this is sort of a little creative. If we're taking, it's from Tim, is there another way to secure a loan with something other than the dwelling? Write up a notarized legal document that's exempt exempt the transaction under Dodd-Frank. That's sort of an interesting question. And could we, you know, going into that further, could we, attach a different that wouldn't work. I guess we'll stick to Tim's original question. Is there another way to secure the loan or secure the loan with something else other than the dwelling in order to go ahead and have a secured loan?
Okay. I can only refer you back to the specifics of what Dodd-Frank says, okay? And it specifically says consumer debt secured by a dwelling.
Okay. There it is.
So if you can think of any way to secure that debt other than a dwelling, My opinion is, and it's my opinion only, it's outside Dodd-Frank for right now. Okay, so let's say that you had diamonds, okay, or you're, I mean, I know this is kind of like off the wall, because if your buyer had diamonds, they probably wouldn't be coming to you for a seller finance transaction anyway, so that's why I kind of sometimes think it might be, you know, out there, but let's theoretically say, okay, that your buyer has something else of equal value to that dwelling, okay, but it's not any type of dwelling at all, and you can take that as the security for that loan, I think it absolutely would fly.
Hmm.
Could they still take you to court? Sure they could.
Absolutely.
But you know as well as I, they can sue you for anything, but you just come up and say, Your Honor, okay, this loan is not secured by that dwelling, okay, it's secured by X. All right, so I think that would fly. But you know, when we look at that, most of the time, they wouldn't be taking you to court if it was secured by that anyway. You know, because your purpose would be wanting to take the dwelling back. But if by some chance you had a buyer who had something that was of more value to you, by all means, I think his idea would work.
Have a hand raised here. Juan, I'm going to go ahead and unmute you. I'm doing this correctly. Juan, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Excellent. Yes, we can. Thank you for coming on.
No problem.
What questions do you have or thoughts?
Well, I was just trying to understand it, because I actually haven't read up on the process, but I wanted to be sure that I was understanding it correctly. In most cases, the people that we're dealing with were unable to, you know, find traditional loans through any banks. So that's why we end up having seller financing. So they come to us to help them get into, you know, in our case specifically, mobile homes, modular homes.
Mm-hmm.
And then so we're going to take these steps, and then they're going to fail by our new requirements as well. What do you see? You know, what do you foresee being option C if we have to start saying, hey, we can't accept you either? What's their potential next step? Like, where do these, you know, where do they do? I feel like there's going to be an overflow of people, and I don't know what that's going to, you know,
Juan, what do you think their option would be if they can't buy? I think you know they're going to rent.
Okay.
They're just going to be renters. Honestly, I think that's the only thing that you're going to be able to help them. I think that's the only way that you're going to be able to help them, because if you can't qualify them, okay, if you cannot qualify them, you have a couple of choices. All right, if you cannot write a qualified loan, then your other choice is to come over into the 8 factors.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, those 8 factors are not as stringent. That they say that you have to consider debt-to-income ratio, but they don't tell you what that ratio is. That's up for you as the lender to decide.
Okay.
They tell you that you have to consider their credit, but that the score is set by the lender. Okay, so you could take a look at their credit, and they could have a 400 credit score, and you could still say, okay, I don't care.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
So you actually all it's saying is that you have to go through those 8 steps.
Okay.
And you have to document that you did that. Now, how stringent or how loose you want to be with your underwriting in those steps, okay, that's entirely up to you. But always keep in mind that the linchpin of this whole thing is you consider their ability to repay. Okay, so I think that if somebody had a 60% debt to income ratio, okay, well, somebody who's only making $1,000 a month and they have a 60% debt to income ratio, that only leaves them $400 to do all their living expenses. You might say that they wouldn't qualify even under your underwriting standards. But what, okay. what if they're making $4,000 a month? Okay, 60% debt to income ratio is only $2,400. That leaves them quite a bit of money to pay for their living expenses, right?
Correct.
So it's going to vary. So I think you know, when I first said they were going to have to rent, that's really not true, because you could loosen. I mean, you could still qualify them based on your underwriting standards, but you would have to show that you took into consideration the ability to pay, and it would have to be reasonable. Okay, I don't think you would be able to get away with a 90% debt to income ratio. Right? I think somebody would kind of squawk at that, because that's totally unreasonable. But I think a 50%, a 55%, if their income was high enough, I think a 60%, right?
Okay.
The old way is, and I do this with my lease options, people say, how do you qualify your tenants? So I say, well, I first check to make sure that they can make the payment. And if they can, they're pretty much there, you know, unless I find something that would rule them out. All right, and that's also true sometimes of our owner financing. Does that help?
Okay. Yes, it does. I just wanted to see what the major, like, our business shift was going to be. So it sounds like we're just going to have to do a lot more paperwork after those original first five. So we'll have a breezy first five every year, and then a less breezy.
Yep.
Okay.
A less breezy the rest of them. That's what I'm thinking.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Juan. If you have anything else, don't hesitate to press star two.
Okay, thank you.
And anybody else, star two is what lets us know that you want to come on the mic. Now these debt to income requirements, safe harbor, all of that is of course still with regards to secured notes, unsecured notes.
That's correct.
Okay.
Unsecured notes, you don't have to worry about it. Nope. Unsecured notes, you can just say, hey, man, I love you. I'm going to give you a loan.
For now.
You know, and for now. Because, I mean, basically, because unsecured, you're out of luck if they stop paying you.
Right.
You wouldn't. You rarely would end up in court with them anyway, except to get a judgment. All right?
Yeah, you're putting up a lot of their pressure.
And you'd stand in line behind everybody else. So, you know, they're not going to worry too much. Dodd-Frank or any of the government regulators or anybody like that's not going to worry about unsecured debt as much as they are secured debt. So you can get away with a lot more if you choose to make it an unsecured loan. You can go back to, hey, I'll give you a loan and balloon it in 5 years as long as it's unsecured. You know, I think that's where some of us are going to get hurt, because most sellers, you know, the best thing about seller financing is they would do a 30-year amortized loan, balloon in 5 years, right? So your payments would be low, and then you'd refinance in 5 years to take your seller out. Well, they can't do those anymore unless they do the 8 qualifications, because believe it or not, you can write your loan any way you want to as long as you consider those 8 underwriting factors and document them.
Where can we learn more about those 8 underwriting factors?
The 8 underwriting factors, you can learn more about that at the Consumer Financial Protection Board. Really, that's all they say about them. They just tell you what the 8 are.
Okay? I'll go ahead and post links in our – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. And I will tell you, I'm going to be doing a white paper, and I will probably have the 8 listed. And if I do a blog, I'll send you the link to the blog, because I'll probably list the 8 there. And the reason I say all you have to do is have the 8 listed to look at, because they don't tell you about them. They don't tell you what – they tell you what you have to consider, okay, but they don't tell you what those things are. So they might say, consider their current employment status. That's all they say for you. That's all they say is for you to consider it. They don't tell you what you've got to consider. They just say consider the employment status. They also say consider the debt-to-income ratio. They don't tell you what the debt-to-income ratio is. They don't make any suggestions as to what it should be. They just say that you've got to document that you considered it.
Wow. Okay. Wow. I know I'm swimming right now. My head, I've learned a lot. We've covered a lot. A good review on. I'm going to have links to A lot of what we talked about here links to the Consumer Protection Bureau, those 8 requirements, a few other things on our Facebook group. Everyone listening, I know there's a number of folks who are not on our Facebook group. I know you have Facebook, so please join. Everyone does. Please, Bill, if you can, if you have a few more minutes, you've been on here for an hour and 15 minutes already, please tell everyone, if you would, or if you care to, you know, a little bit more about what you do, where people can learn more about what you do, and then also sort of moving forward, because, I mean, heck, lease options, which I think you're getting into properties with lease options, and then
I do a lot of lease option assignments. A lot of subject to purchases and sell on lease options. And when you say sell on lease options, you actually are leasing with an option to buy. So you're not selling. Excuse me, I'm afraid to say that anymore. So I'm not going to say that I sell my properties on lease options anymore. I'm going to say that I lease them to tenant buyers. Okay, put it that way. But that's mainly what I do. That's my investing niche. In addition to being a full-time real estate investor, I'm also a business and tax strategist. My undergraduate degree is in finance and accounting, and then I have an advanced master's degree in tax law. So that's why I heartily confess to being a tax geek. I just enjoy that. I do it from the strategy angle. I started off with, once I did my internship with an accountant, I opened up my own practice, and I ended up being an accountant and tax strategist for real estate investors. And I loved the niche, and I found out very quickly after doing a couple of seasons of tax returns that the profits were on the other side of the desk. And I said, hey, these real estate investors are making some darn good chunk of change. And so I, you know, sold my practice out to my partner after a few years, and I went into full-time real estate investing, thinking that I would never do the tax stuff anymore. Fortunately, I have not done the tax prep stuff, so I don't do anything with the forms for any of my clients, but I still was able to marry my two loves, my tax and business stuff, along with my real estate investing. And my coaching is from a business standpoint that I think a lot of coaches kind of ignore. They teach you the strategy. They teach you how to invest with lease options. They teach you how to do bulk REOs. They teach you how to do short sales. But they don't teach you diddly squat about building a business and, you know, the numerous tax advantages that we as entrepreneurs have. And we are a walking tax deduction. And one of my big things is living a tax deductible lifestyle. And so one of the things I help my clients do, I always say that I like to help them make more, spend less, and keep Uncle Sam out of their pockets. So I like to be able to take, you know, make as much of my day-to-day expenses deductible business expenses as I can. So that's kind of like my thing. That's what I enjoy doing. So if anybody is interested, they can find out more about me at my blog. It's Bill on Business, BillOnBusiness, BillOnBusiness.net. And I have a lot of articles over there on how to write off your next vacation and how to do lease options, how to do lease option assignments, those types of things. So I'd love for you guys to come over if you have a chance, take a read, leave comments. There's a place there that you can get in touch with me. I love answering questions. As I have just shown, I could talk about this stuff all night.
Brilliant. I love that you were able to do the two things that you love and something that, you're right, I certainly don't harp on it enough, is that if you do not have a CPA that's also a real estate player, you know, in the game with property, you need something. And this is you're right. People don't talk about it enough. I do not talk about it enough to the folks here. So please, you know, and now you can help folks all around the country, not just.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've got clients and coaching students everywhere. And, you know, like I said, a lot of times I'll talk tax strategy, and I'll teach my students a strategy, and they implement it, and then, you know, I say, hey, here's what I think you need to do. You need to structure your deals this way. Run it by your tax person. And one thing, since it's that end of the year, I would like to stress to everybody, don't wait until an end of a year and then try to find out whether something's deductible. Talk to your tax person all during the year and make sure that you're structuring your stuff as you go along so that it's deductible, because you can't go back after the transaction has taken place and do much about it. Okay, so if you don't have a good tax person, you really need to get one.
Great tip. Exactly. Love it. So BillOnBusiness.net, go there if you're listening on a recorded version of this or live. Go read the articles, comment, please. And Bill, I love, you're just so available. You really are, for lack of a better word, guru, but you really are just, you know, a wealth of information, and you're so approachable. So I just thank you so much for being here. We got about a half dozen of folks that have just, they're, you know, realizing that this is sort of the end, and have said thank you.
And, okay. Tell them thank you very much. I'd love to be in here. And
thank you very
like
much.
I said, I'm not sure how long you guys go, John. So if you've got anybody who has a few last questions, you know, I don't mind staying around. I'll stick around as long as you do.
Let's see. The few that came in are just all a couple more. Dave, thank you so much for being here. Absolutely. Mary, thanks, Bill, for everything. We've learned a lot. Gary, a bunch of thanks. Let's see who's on the phone. Anybody else with a question? No, listen, your time is valuable.
Okay,
and it's, you know, it's a little bit later there than where you are. Everybody on the East Coast, thanks for tuning in. We actually had a VIP. We actually had a call last night that lasted until about 10:30. And
oh wow,
we had sort of a we got a lot of talking in and questions in there. So no, this was just a wealth of information. If there's any other sort of trailing questions that maybe didn't come through because the system is slow for some reason. Is it all right if I shoot those over to you, Bill, and then or can
oh,
I
absolutely.
Shoot to
yep.
the people?
Okay. Absolutely. Perfect. Do that. And also tell them that if they go to the blog,
mm-hmm.
There's a contact form there. Tell them to feel free to drop their question into the contact form. It'll come directly to me, and I'll shoot them an answer back.
Brilliant. I think everybody heard that. And this is going to be good. I'm going to have this for I'm going to post this, if you don't mind, the recorded version just for our members to see in the members area. So it'll be for now, for the foreseeable future. And, again, I think if there's one person that I would like to promote that is, you know, does what they say that they're going to do and knows what they're talking about, it's going to be you. So thank you so much for being here, Bill. And
have
a great night. All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you
Appreciate
so
it.
Much.
And I will
right. we'll
see you
soon.
Guys later. All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. If you have any other questions or concerns, you should have got them in while we were all talking. But if you were nervous or scared or something, or you think of it later, you have Bill's information. That's BillOnBusiness.net. And then you can also email us, of course. And that's about it. Thank you guys for being here, and ladies as well, of course. We've been on here for about an hour and a half. There will be a recorded version of this in the members area. Thank you for being here, and we are going to have a number of updates coming up soon in the members area with regards to the changes in these acts. It's not going to be so much through modules 1 through 4 with regards to mobile homes and parks, but there will be differences with regards to reselling manufactured homes attached to real land, because we do want to secure all of those notes, very important. So with that said, those changes will be later on into the modules. If you have any other questions or concerns, you can contact myself, which do me a favor, if you do email Bill, I'd love to sort of hear those questions as well, because just like in our Facebook group, we're all here to learn and grow together. So a question that I know a number of you asked, as soon as you asked it, I had the same question. So thank you for everybody for participating, how much you did, and have a great night. Thank you so much for being here, and I will talk to you all soon. Bye-bye.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye.